Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Before we get started, we want to get you to check out our last couple podcasts. We did an episode about Neighbors. It's on our website, themacguffinmen.com. And before that, we talked about Boogie Nights. A week before that, James and I were joined by Emily, and we talked about the greatest film ever made, Mean Girls. if you need updates on what we're up to, follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Man, all one word, no underscores, and subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can get these new podcasts automatically. So that's helpful.
Yeah, if we decide there's a new number one movie in the history of cinema, you'll be first to know.
You might decide that. I can guarantee you, I will not. Mean Girls is basically the Citizen Kane of teen movies, so it will never be bested. Anyways, we're not talking about Citizen Kane or teen movies today, so we'll just get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James. I suppose I lied. There are teen elements in the movies we're talking about today, but they're not the primary elements. What are we talking about today?
You don't want to do another Mean Girls one?
I'm always ready to do a Mean Girls podcast. Do you want to just take this over, do a Mean Girls podcast? Can I send one of us back in time to change the conversation to when we decide to just do another Mean Girls podcast?
Nice segue. Yeah. We were talking about X-Men Days of Future Past.
Yes.
And to go off your last comment there about going back in time to the conversation where we decided to do this podcast. You, as you sometimes do, came up with an idea on how to do this podcast.
Yeah.
So why don't you, sometimes I don't get it right away, and then we do the podcast and it works out, like the Dave Chappelle episode and some other ones I can think of.
Yeah. Well, the Dave Chappelle idea is like my high point as a podcaster.
Well, yeah, why don't you explain to me and thereby the listener how you want to do this one? Because it's a bit different than our normal just analyze a single movie topic.
Yeah, well, I mean, Days of Future Past seemed like a movie that would be worth talking about. We've never talked about a Bryan Singer X-Men movie, and we did do a podcast on First Class, but not sort of the earlier X-Men movies. And with Days of Future Past coming out, looking interesting, doing some things that we haven't seen in a superhero movie before, and the fact that it's the newest installment in the franchise that is basically responsible for the modern superhero film. I always find in conversations people remember Spider-Man, the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man, as coming out before X-Men, which is just not the case. X-Men came out in 2000, and it kind of set, it was the first superhero movie, so I figured I hadn't seen it in a long time. It might be a good idea to go back and rewatch it and see what elements of X-Men 1 have remained as a part of the way the superhero genre, and what has fallen away, and whether either of these things are good or bad, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, it's been a decade and a half since that movie.
Yeah, 14 years ago.
And as anyone who has seen a television commercial break or been in the movie theater in the past 14 years knows, there have been a lot of superhero movies in the meantime. Mm-hmm. And we had, you know, The Avengers being literally the biggest movie ever. Mm-hmm. So yeah, lots of movies, lots of big you know, blockbusters. It's pretty much the tent poles in the summer now are mostly superhero movies. So I don't know where we are in the boom exactly, but it seems like we are certainly in a superhero boom. And I like this idea of kind of seeing what started it. And, you know, with so much money, so much scrutiny into the genre now, you would think some things are going to fall away if they're not, you know, successful, proven moneymakers, and some things are going to show up new and, you know, repeat themselves if they are making money. So How do you want to do this? You want to talk about X-Men first, or
I figured
jump back and forth between them, or
let's send my
consciousness back to talk about one movie.
I've got Ellen Page on standby, so we're ready to go.
Ellen Page is a dream guide. Like, I don't know why this is her role in movies now, but I think it works.
Yeah, well, I mean, she had this one locked down before Inception.
So, no, I know.
Yeah. Yeah, so Christopher Nolan's biting Brett Ratner.
Again.
Classic Nolan move. Memento was basically a remake of Rush Hour. I suppose let's talk about the first X-Men movie, because I guess I don't have that much to say about it. Because I think the main thing I learned from watching X-Men again is that not a ton of things have changed. You know?
Yeah.
It definitely did set out a template, and there are some things that really did change. It's a much shorter movie than most superhero movies. Even Days of Future Past is only 2 hours and 10 minutes, and that's shorter than most superhero movies still.
I know. The fact that we're saying it's only 2 hours and 10 minutes for, you know, action movies used to be 90 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Like, the fact that this is our short movie now.
Yeah,
says,
I mean,
something about the trend.
That wasn't always that. I mean, it's kind of ebb and flow. I mean, Die Hard's like 2 hours and 8 minutes or something like that. So, and that's kind of like the high watermark of modern action cinema. But yeah, anyway, the X-Men's 1 hour and 44 minutes long, all in, and that will not happen again with a summer tentpole blockbuster action movie, because these things just have to be seen as more epic. And that was kind of one of the things I really enjoyed about watching X-Men now. I remember liking it at the time, but I certainly wasn't crazy about it. But the thing that I find it likable about it now is just how charming the scale of it is, and that it's just small, you know, like, there was a lot at stake at the end, but not a huge number of people, really, you know?
Yeah, and throughout it, there's the one, obviously the fight sequence in the train station puts some people at risk, but yeah, a lot of the time it's, you know, Sabretooth attacking Rogue and Logan in the wood, like, on the road, and a lot of small individual things.
Yeah, and very short sequences, too. That sequence is kind of the first real action scene in the movie, and it's very short, like the first big setup. We've got the sort of Wolverine bar fight, but that's like, you know, Rogue screaming and then three punches. Even just looking at Days of Future Past, it opens on a pretty grand action sequence. And it's very much the norm. Whereas one of the things I remember, maybe not at the time because I was 14 at the time, but looking back on X-Men as kind of the first movie and something I still like now in superheroes, or in it being the first superhero movie, is that the opening action sequence is like young Magneto at a Holocaust concentration camp, you know?
Yep.
that's really interesting, and I can't imagine that happening again, you know?
No, and I think it's not that it's so heavy that it couldn't happen again.
Mm-hmm.
But for an intro sequence, I mean, we had Nazis in Captain America 1 and a little bit in 2.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's such a heavy, dark scene, and that's the intro, and then, you know, eventually things get moving after a bit. But yeah, considering now we're kind of used to opening on a big action sequence, for the action to be, you know, five adults holding back a child while he bends a fence with his mind, it's pretty small scale,
yeah,
action wise but so heavy emotionally just because of the subject matter.
Yeah, and I thought it did a really good job of setting up the Eric Lencher Magneto character, and very, very quick. I think the scene's probably like 3 or 4 minutes long total, and then we're into the not so distant future, as the card says. But I thought that was like a really well done, interesting intro, and it really sets up the whole theme of discrimination that's present all throughout the X-Men movies, particularly the good ones. You know, it's very strong in those.
Yeah. And yeah, plenty of it in these two X-Men movies too. I like the first X-Men and Days of Future Past.
Yeah. And I watched X2 again, and very present in that as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
I liked it way more than I thought I was going to. I always remember liking it and then kind of just assumed I'd like it a little bit less watching it recently. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, it's really enjoyable. it's just, it's a good time. The thing that I was surprised by was how little character growth there is at all. I seem to remember there being like more of a focus on Wolverine and at least getting something out of him. But the thing that really jumps to mind, and this was still very present in X2, is, I guess Wolverine is in love with Jean Grey because she exists. You know, like that's kind of it. They never really have a conversation about anything. It's just kind of, well, Wolverine loves her, you know, and just love triangle, you know. And I think there's tons of interesting stuff in X-Men. I just don't think that individual characters really get all that much.
No. The whole thing between them seems to be, you know, he wakes up and sees an attractive woman and he's Logan, so he's going to hit on her.
Yeah.
I mean, she looks like Famke Janssen, so it's what you do. But yeah, then after that, he just seems immediately and permanently enamored with her without kind of putting in the legwork story-wise on why that's the case.
Yeah. I felt like there was interesting stuff with Logan kind of, or Wolverine kind of accepting being part of a collective, but it just kind of wasn't fleshed out well enough for me to like it all that much. Like, you know, it was fine, but it felt like it could have been done a lot better. And I suppose the strongest character stuff is Logan and Rogue's relationship. But even that's not particularly strong, you know?
Yeah. Oh, well, you started off by saying how much you like it. Now all you're doing is telling me the things you don't like about
it. Well, the things I do like about it, and this bleeds into Days of Future Past as well, is kind of the bigger stuff. And like the idea of the discrimination, mutants just kind of being, the idea of mutants are hated and they're hated because they're different. And it's just kind of really good stand-in for any sort of discrimination. And I felt like that's really interesting. And the other thing I really enjoyed about it is just kind of the placement of Xavier and Magneto, just all of their conversations and the idea that Magneto's more of a conventional villain in the first X-Men movie than he is in any other following X-Men movie. But just the fact that they're friends is interesting, and they just kind of set themselves up as friends and we just accept it. But they're interesting. The characters are well acted. And the idea that, you know, Charles is fighting for thought, whereas Magneto is kind of just fighting for action, you know? And I feel like the thought versus action idea is interesting. Like Magneto wants to force people to listen to him by doing something, whereas Xavier wants, hopes, and feels like people will eventually listen to him if they keep trying, you know? And I think that's kind of like a really, I mean, that's the basis of their relationship, but I feel like that's, it's really interesting, you know, and I just like it a lot.
Yeah, no, it's a cool dynamic because they're both, you know, very intelligent and very, very driven and definitely have opinions about the way that the world should function and go about it through very different means, which is why their friendship can work, is all those things I listed that they have in common. And then there is something, such a massive disconnect in when it comes to the execution of these ideas.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. going back to some of the exclusionary stuff you're talking about, some of the kind of social aspects of, you know, leaving people out and, you know, making people illegal in certain ways.
Yeah.
Just in the first one, I thought they do a really interesting job of hitting on a bunch of these, you know, marginalized throughout history sections of the population. And, you know, right away, obviously, we get the Holocaust and, you know, throughout the movie with the tattoos and kind of, you know, saying, you know, they're just going to put a number on you and treat you like this. We get a lot of pretty plain allusions to the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And Senator Kelly's hearings, we get, I don't know, I get sort of a McCarthyism vibe from that really strongly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, obviously trying to out and demonize communists in the 50s in America. And at that one point, you know, he says, he holds up that list and says, you know, we know who they are. That's very similar to something Senator McCarthy did, saying he was aware of the communists that are working in the U.S. government right now. And then homosexuality, it's a subject that I think a lot of people picked up on and have discussed a lot in this film. Kind of the mutants as homosexuals and people not being comfortable around them and wanting them to be identified and, you know, treated differently. And
they go all out with that in X2.
Yes, yeah. I do remember that about X2. Yeah. They hit it pretty hard there. Yeah, but I like how it's not just that. I mean, in X2, I think it's so much more blatantly that, okay, these mutants are now a stand-in for homosexuals. But I thought in this one, they do a good job of making it anybody who is not in the majority or anybody who is different than someone in power. And I just think they did a kind of a good job to alluding to all these different times throughout history. You know, we have the 1930s and 40s Holocaust. We have communism in the 50s. We have homosexuality, you know, throughout tons of history. But specifically that one line he says about, you know, we don't want these people teaching our kids. That was from the argument of the Section 28. Do you remember this, that Ian McKellen was even involved in?
No.
Yeah, he was Ian McKellen, you know, being an out homosexual. There was a debate in the States about homosexuality and especially teachers and having people, you know, kind of the way Kelly says in this, Senator Kelly, you know, do we want them teaching our kids? Do we want them doing things like that? Again, just kind of talking about one other section of the population as a group to be victimized. So I thought with kind of that social exclusionary stuff, I really liked how they didn't make it just one thing the way that is. It's so heavy in number two about homosexuality. Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting in this one that, you know, you don't have to be a homosexual or a communist or a Jew or, you know, any of these specific things. But if you kind of paint it with this really broad stroke, it's a lot easier for you to see how this could apply to anybody and how, you know, kind of the tyranny of the majority can apply to lots of different groups.
Yeah, for sure. And one moment that I found really, really great in X-Men that I had never thought about before. Like, I even remembered that scene before watching the movie and didn't think about it, was before the fight breaks out at the train station, there's a kid that looks at Cyclops. And, you know, he smiles at Cyclops. Cyclops smiles back. And then his mom, the kid's mom, pulls him away and like sees who he's smiling at and pulls him away. And I thought that was a really, really interesting visual representation of just the idea that the idea of discrimination is something that is taught. You know, it's not innate. Like, kids don't discriminate. They have to be taught for somehow to kind of just not respect something that's different from them. And I thought that was a really, really great, quick moment that really added a lot to the movie.
Yeah, and it's not a kind of that awkward glance where the kid is looking at this man and doesn't understand something about him and might be making him uncomfortable. The mother just sees someone who is obviously different in one way than her and, you know, removes her child from the situation.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's exactly as you described. It's learned behavior. And that's one little moment that kind of sums up so much about what I think this franchise, but especially this movie, is trying to say.
Yeah, for sure. One other little thing that I felt was very timely for X-Men, Senator Kelly, when he's on his helicopter, I believe, he's talking on the phone about some legislation he's trying to get enacted about not allowing mutants into schools. And he says the line, "All I see are weapons in the schools," and he's comparing mutants to guns. And this is barely a year past Columbine. And I thought that was interesting. And we get sort of a different style of playing with history in the later X-Men movies. And but it was interesting to see that the franchise has always been willing to, even in a more abstract way in X-Men, engage with real world events, you know, or real world elements.
Yeah, no, and it's so close to that time. So, yeah.
And it's just something that I think, I'm sure, just as people making an action movie, it, every big tentpole action movie had to have the discussion, like, what is to, what do we have to remove because of Columbine, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's the same thing that happened after 9/11, you know, just on a different level.
Yeah. And then mentioning Spider-Man early on, that commercial that they had to stop airing where he catches the bank robbers in a helicopter between the Twin Towers.
Yeah. The first trailer for that movie. Yeah, there were a lot of things that that were interesting about this movie. And I think like a couple of the big things that I think really set a tone for the way superhero movies would be seen is the characters are really put in. It does say, you know, in the not so distant future, but the characters are put in a pretty recognizable world, you know, and even their outfits. There's a comment by Wolverine that, you know, references the actual comic jumpsuits that the X-Men would wear, and they just end up in the movie actually wearing a more practical version of something like that, but something that that could conceivably work in the real world and wouldn't make you look like a lunatic, you know. It just looks like you're on a Ducati basically without the motorcycle. But yeah, and I thought that was something that really sort of stood out, is the way that this world is mostly recognizable, and there's just some things change.
Yeah, no, he comments on the outfit saying, do you want to go out in these? And someone says, yeah, would you prefer yellow spandex?
Yeah,
it's, I guess, because it's not as though this was literally the first superhero movie.
No, not at all. And Bryan Singer has always said, I mean, Richard Donner is an executive producer on this movie. Lauren Shuler, Donner's wife, has been a producer on all the X-Men movies, I believe. Very strongly influenced by Richard Donner's Superman movie, which is kind of the real beginning. You know, this is just kind of the modern beginning.
Yeah. And we have... Yeah, I only bring that up to say there still had to be that idea in their mind of how can we do this without it being silly?
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean? And then that's where you get the black leather outfits that are more practical and tactical and something you could conceivably see somebody trying to fight in than the blue and yellow.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean... I did a quick scan of other people that have who did some writing work on this movie, and the only one that stuck out to me was Joss Whedon. And apparently the reason his script was mostly rejected, apparently there's a couple lines from it that remained in the movie, but it was just like too quippy, basically. It was too much like a Buffy episode, basically.
Yeah, he said it was way too much pop culture, is what I understand.
Yeah. And that sort of led me to think about how just the fact that Bryan Singer, his selection as the director really set the tone for the types of directors that were selected for these projects. And that kind of continues now. It's just kind of casts a wider net. You know, most directors that get the reins to these franchises don't really get them for having previously done a big blockbuster movie. You know, Bryan Singer's most famous and I think only successful movie before X-Men was The Usual Suspects, you know, and now James Gunn is doing Guardians of the Galaxy off of the, you know, the non-success of Super, you know, and that's something that's really sort of stuck. They just kind of trust that a person that knows how to make a movie can make a movie for a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah, and my understanding is that they liked Bryan Singer's ability to handle the ensemble cast that was in Usual Suspects.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense to me, but it seems so weird to me that, you know, we've discussed Usual Suspects. We both really like the movie. But to see that movie and say, yeah, I think this is the guy to do X-Men, is such a weird leap to me.
Yeah, and they like had to really try to get him onto the project, too.
Yeah, but and I remember a while ago asking you if you ever seen The Rocketeer, which was a kind of superhero movie from a while ago.
Yeah, and Joe Johnson did that movie, right?
Yeah.
The guy that directed Captain America.
Yeah, exactly. And I had seen it after I saw Captain America, and I asked you if you'd seen it, and you said no. And I said, it's so much like Captain America. And you said, basically, they just find someone to make a movie that, so find a director who's already made a movie they like and say, make it again, but with these people.
Yeah.
And, or with these characters. And, yeah, that it's such a, just the disconnect for me between, Usual Suspects and this is, it seems so big, but I love that idea. I love the approach of, you know, don't just, you can clearly make superhero movies, keep making superhero movies. It's this mentality of, you know, you can make a good movie, make this good movie, make this movie good.
Yeah.
I just want to go back to one thing you said about directors and casting. How about for a difference between superhero movies then and superhero movies now, hiring pretty much an unknown to play Wolverine?
Yeah, and I mean, the Wolverine story by itself is kind of weird because Doug Ray Scott, who's probably most notable for the villain being the villain in Mission Impossible 2,
which is not a compliment.
You know, he was also the love interest in what was that Drew Ever After, that Drew Barrymore movie that also Cinderella sucked. Yeah. And yeah, it was a Cinderella movie, wasn't it? Anyway, he was cast as Wolverine. Apparently, it was very much a studio pick because the movie revolves so much around Wolverine. The studio really wanted, you know, to put their imprint on it. And he broke his ankle doing reshoots for Mission Impossible 2. So Hugh Jackman wasn't even cast until apparently over a month had already passed in production. And yeah, it kind of worked out, I think, you know. Hugh Jackman's great as Wolverine.
Well, it worked out for everybody. Like,
except Doug Ray Scott.
Well, yeah, everyone who matters.
Yeah. I'm sure his ankle's doing well, though.
No, I just mean, it gave, I mean, it's that you could argue that Hugh Jackman would have had a decent career otherwise, but you can't ignore the fact that this really accelerated it.
Yeah.
And gave him 43 movies to play Wolverine in.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe without this ripple in the pond, he never brings back the musical at the Oscars.
No one gets that joke.
I don't give a shit. I love that reference so much. My fist is in the air celebrating that reference.
He's back on Broadway next year, by the way. Anyway.
Can't wait. I'm going.
No, I think I just mean it worked out for Hugh Jackman for his career. I think it worked out for the X-Men movies because I think he plays a wonderful Wolverine, and people always liked Wolverine. I think he was arguably the favorite X-Men. I mean, people love him.
Yeah, for sure.
But so it worked out for him that, I mean, people still love him, still love Wolverine. I can't say that's all Hugh Jackman's doing is my point, but yeah. People by and large seem to be pleased with someone who is taking on a pretty tough role, pretty big shoes to fill.
Yeah. There are some people that, some really dedicated comics fans that still don't like the idea that he's, you know, a tall person, but because Wolverine's always short in the comics, but that's such a small complaint. Pun intended.
I'm not even gonna address that. But I what I meant by hiring an unknown is just to take, if they were to do another X-Men movie, to take someone who is barely known outside of Australia or outside of their home country to play any of the main characters, let alone a character this big, or, you know, just in superhero movies in general. Do you find that a little weird? Or I guess we have some contemporary. I mean, Henry Cavill was barely.
Yeah, Superman has traditionally been cast as an unknown. Like Christopher Reeve was an unknown, so that allowed them to get away with that. Yeah, I don't know. Because, I mean, part of it is, I mean, you address the ensemble nature. You've got Patrick Stewart, so you've got all the Trekkies, the Trekkers. So you've got that money. So you can kind of play around a bit, you know? Mm-hmm. There is a strong, there's an amount of people that were already probably in off of Patrick Stewart, even as silly as that might seem. Never underestimate the Star Trek fans.
Yeah, especially to go out to see a comic book movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think since it's an ensemble, there was a little element that they were allowed to play around with a bit more. But it's not. The thing that jumps to mind is Christian Bale as Batman, but it's not like he was unknown. He was just not a superstar, you know?
Yeah.
So I think we get a lot of things like that where people are kind of known properties but have never had a big hit because they kind of have to be, you know, you can't cast somebody that's already really strongly identified with a role to be another superhero. You know, like if the Fantastic Four movies had been world shakers, Chris Evans couldn't also be Captain America.
Yeah, that's who I was just thinking of. That's someone who people knew, but they wouldn't say, you know, oh, he's this guy, like, you know, another character.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Do you want to talk a bit about Days of Future Past?
I think we should. I just want to bring up, now, since we've been talking about Wolverine, the moment when there are two Wolverines and then the real Wolverine wins the fight. And, you know, he's saying, I'm the real Wolverine to Cyclops. Cyclops says, prove it. Wolverine says, you're a dick.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
That's a Joss Whedon line.
Is that actually?
That's one of his two.
Oh, great.
That is 100% true.
Well played, Joss.
The other one is, do you know what happens to a toad when it's struck by lightning?
Okay.
But yes, that is a fantastic exchange, the one that you brought up.
It's
and
so funny.
It's so Wolverine. Like, it's...
Well, and up to that point, I had been kind of underwhelmed by Hugh Jackman's performance because I remember him being really good as Wolverine, and he is really good as Wolverine, but he's really finding his feet or his footing in this movie. And that's where we get like a really great flash of the best elements of Hugh Jackman as Wolverine.
Yeah, because he's... I mean, he's obviously rough around the edges the whole time, but you don't get that... kind of funny asshole very much in this movie. Like, that's one. There's a couple with Cyclops. So a couple other ones with Cyclops relevant to Jean Grey.
Yeah,
that you get it. But yeah, most of the time he's kind of just gruff instead of hilariously cocky.
Yeah. There's also one shot that really jumped out at me. Like, there's some montage early at the beginning, and then they cut back. I think it's when Logan first arrives at the school and Xavier's talking to him about the school, and he's just explaining a lot to Logan. There's cut away to a montage of sorts, and then they come back to the room and then cut away to one shot of Cyclops standing by his motorcycle teaching kids, and it's so awkward and makes no sense until Wolverine steals his motorcycle later on, and it's just like they couldn't figure out any other way to work that shot in there, and they must know it's so awkward, but still really trying to find ways to set up jokes in superhero movies, I guess.
Oh, okay. I have a question for you. I forgot to put this in my notes. I don't know if this was you that we used to joke about this with, but the other awkward part of this movie for me is after Mystique as whatever.
Sorry, you cut out.
The Ice Kid, what's his name?
Iceman?
Is that his name?
Yeah, or Bobby.
Bobby. It was Bobby I was looking for.
Body chilled, so. Or Bobby chilled bottle service.
So Mystique, disguised as Bobby, convinces Rogue to leave the academy.
Yeah.
Okay. And so then after this, we get the real Bobby walking around the hallways with his friends. Yeah. And his friend asks him, when was the last time you saw her? And he says, she was supposed to meet me for lunch. And then everyone pretends like that's a real answer to that question. And the scene just ends.
That was not me that you joked about that with, but I'm willing to joke about that with you in the future, James.
Okay, someone else then. But it is such a clunky piece of dialogue that doesn't really, like, it has such a small purpose to serve that could be addressed with a very small tweak to that line, like, this morning, instead of saying when she was supposed to meet you.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, you just brought up awkward parts of this movie, and that is, like, my number one awkward moment in this whole franchise.
That's fine.
Okay.
We'll use that really strong segue into Days of Future Past.
Sure.
Where there's also food at some point, probably.
Yeah.
There's also mornings and lunches. Days of Future Past, the new X-Men film.
Mm. I had a good time.
Yeah, I really liked it a lot.
Okay, I didn't know how you'd feel about it, to be honest.
I
knew some parts that I thought you would really like. And again, I feel like I've been saying this too much recently, but I'm going to say the front half is way better. Although there were some things I really did enjoy in the second half.
I think there are... Yeah, I mean, as far as, like, an entertaining action movie, I think you're definitely right. As far as... I like the climax of this movie because it's a weird climax that doesn't it's the type of climax that doesn't happen very frequently. It's the Bourne ultimatum thing. Like, what's the real climax of this movie? It's Mystique choosing not to kill somebody. And I liked that. And I don't think superhero movies end in such a way that leaves you with so many things to think about, as opposed to, I mean, we talked about this in the Captain America Winter Soldier podcast, so I don't want to bring it up too much. The whole setting up of the next movie is such a big element of the last 10 minutes, whereas the last 10 minutes of this movie wraps up this movie. Mm-hmm. And I really like that a lot. That's something I liked about the climax, was that it really put a nice button on the point of this movie. And I thought that was cool. I do agree the best stuff does happen in the first hour of this movie. I really like this movie in a way that I didn't think I would be this passionate about a superhero movie again. Like after Nolan was done with Batman, I thought I'd never get this into a superhero movie again. But I really liked it a lot.
It's funny that you say you like the last 10 minutes so much, because it really kind of focuses on this movie and wraps things up. I mean, for everything that was just talked about for the past 2 hours.
I know it does set up other stuff, but
no, it does. That's not what I mean. It's funny. But this movie is so all over the place for 2 hours. And I don't mean that like it's poorly scripted or plotted or anything, but because of the different locations, because of the different versions of the same people, because of the timelines, I think it needed kind of a sense of finality, because it's really scattered in a terribly negative way. I just think it's there is so much going on, and you know, we get at points. I don't think there's really a clear villain for a lot of this movie.
That's one of the questions I had. Who is the villain of this movie? That's one of the things I love about this movie. Like, who do we hate?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at. And I was going to ask you about this separately, but you brought it up. It doesn't always have a clear villain. Even if you did know who the villain was, it seems like a lot of their actions are inconsequential. And I know this sounds super negative, but I promise I'm getting to something with this. You know, because it was, if we can kill Trask, then the Sentinels won't happen. And it's like, oh, well, if we almost kill Trask, then they need the Sentinels, and then they're going to be super Sentinels. And, you know,
yeah, because by almost killing Trask, the public ends up seeing us, you know?
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah. And it was like, oh, well, if Mystique kills someone, this will happen. But if she doesn't kill them, then they can do this and this will happen. And it all kind of leads to the same place, no matter what happens in the plot in so many ways. So I think that, because it was so, and again, I don't mean this pejoratively, disjointed and scattered, I think it really needed a tight bow to be like, okay, look, this is what actually did happen. Mm-hmm. This is what this actually means. Here is the real end of this movie. Now we are into multiverses and erasing history and some of the past entries into this franchise not meaning anything anymore. But I just think that the reason that this has kind of a tight ending is because there are just so many question marks throughout this movie that they needed something to be kind of definitive.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I loved it, though.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know. Because, I mean, Trask is a bad guy, I guess, but you never really feel like he's evil or the main threat.
Well, it's the same thing with Senator Kelly in the first X-Men movie. He's the threat, but he's not. It's not like he's, I don't know. It's not like he was ever going to be in a fight scene, you know? So they're not traditional superhero movie villains at all.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, we also have Nixon, but he's just generally an asshole, not a superhero villain. Yeah. And again, another guy we're not going to see as our big bad in the final sequence. Mm-hmm. And then we have Magneto's evil, but he's also on our team for half of this movie.
Yeah.
Trying to.
Well, yeah, that's kind of the. And it's just something that in thinking about this movie and the X-Men franchise as much as I have over the past week, it's just kind of something that's a part of the property that they wisely did not eliminate from the movies is just the relationship between Xavier and Magneto is just so wonderful and fascinating and fun to think about.
Yeah. And it gave me a little bit of like a reminder of Looper, going back and talking to your younger self or passing a message on from your older self to your younger self. And, you know, what do you say? What can convince them? Weren't you so different, you know, 40 years ago that you won't even be able to communicate? Like, just a lot of those questions kind of came up and were dealt with. And I really liked that. Mm-hmm. I like time travel in general. So that's okay with me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's when time travel movies are well done, it's pretty great. I'm a big fan. Yeah.
Speaking of things being well done, this movie, I think I can confidently say, has the, or at least one of the funniest, like, set piece scenes in a superhero movie. And that's Quicksilver's slow-mo scene.
Yes.
It was so wonderful. And I was like, once it kind of started, I kind of thought I got the joke and what was happening. But as it played out, it was just fantastic. And, you know, there might be other lines or other little bits in the past, you know, let's say the superhero boom starting with the first X-Men, as we've been discussing.
Yeah.
But for a set piece, for a whole scene, for comic relief during what's some pretty heavy shit going down, for, you know, a good use of music, a good use of visual effects, and a scene that actually moves the plot forward. I thought it was just perfect. I thought it was bang on.
I agree with everything you just said. Okay. Every single word.
And I think the kid who plays Quicksilver was great.
I thought he was really annoying in his first scene, and then when he's from the point where he's in the elevator on, I was fine with him. Maybe I just kept wishing he was played by Trevor from The Whitest Kids You Know, because he looks just enough like him.
That would have been a terrible idea.
But you would have loved it, though.
I think I would have, yes. but begrudgingly.
Yeah.
I would have hated that I loved it.
But yeah, no, that action sequence is amazing. And yeah, I think so rarely do you get such a well-done action sequence. And I always get really excited by action sequences in a way that still, like, surprises me. But, like, I mean, the Inception hallway fight is a high watermark for me. And that Skyfall shadow fight in the one take was really great. Like, those types of things where you get movement of the plot and a reinforcement of some of the ideas that have been discussed. And it's also incredibly fucking entertaining and something that's done in a way that you kind of don't see very frequently or ever, you know, like I can't think of the best comparison point for the Quicksilver scene is the beginning of X2, the Nightcrawler sequence where he's trying to assassinate the president, but very different points to the scene. And yeah, just really, really engaging. Really great sequence.
Yeah, and as I said, you know, it's at a heavy part of the movie, and it's just classic. Like, Shakespeare knew it. You know, you can have these heavy moments, and then you get that comic relief, and you know, you give everyone a laugh, you make everything good. But by the time that's over, you've elevated the danger or the gravitas of whatever was you dealing with before that. And yeah, the sequence itself was just wonderful. You mentioned Inception.
I did. Do we want to go down this path? Do you want to get me talking about Inception?
No. Okay. I heard someone call it the movie Inception today. Like, I wouldn't understand what he meant if it was just Inception. But anyway, side note. The differences between X-Men and X-Men Days of Future Past, did you see a lot of kind of what had happened to action movies in the meantime in this movie, or any, you know, you said Inception, and I thought the airplane scene reminded me of the hallway scene just a little bit, and also a little bit of the Dark Knight Rises introduction scene. Did you see any kind of modern action allusions, or
not really? I don't think I thought too much about it. I think mostly what I really enjoyed about this movie is comparatively to most even if we just let's look at the climax of this, the climactic action sequence of this movie and the climactic action sequence of Captain America: The Winter Soldier. Winter Soldier has like helicarriers crashing into buildings and stuff, and I know Magneto does move RFK Stadium, but it's still like he's just to wrap things out, you know, and then what happens inside of it, the actual action sequence is pretty small scale. And I thought that was a thought that really carried through the movie. You know, there's never really a point where more than 10,000 lives are at stake, you know? And I mean, that's just a rough guess, but that was something I really enjoyed. And that's something that tends to hold in most action movies that I really like, is the idea that not everybody is at risk. You know, it's kind of more about the idea than just like, oh, the world's in danger, it's the Avengers, gotta stop it, otherwise we're all dead. I bet, guys, I bet they're gonna stop it because they need a world for a sequel to exist in, you know?
Right.
And I think they're, I mean, you still expect things to end generally well, but the fact that not everything is at risk kind of leaves more room for interesting stuff to happen, as weird as that sounds, you know.
No, it makes sense. I thought him lifting and moving the stadium was awesome. Like, I
so cool.
Yeah, I was just very happy about that. Like, the second I kind of started realizing what was happening and where this was going, I was getting really excited. Yeah. No, but it absolutely speaks to your point. It's, you know, he has these crazy abilities. He has he's so powerful. He can move this whole stadium and surround the White House with it. But then it's what happens inside. And it's, you know, getting to these few important people who can, who, you know, Trask has these ideas and has these plans. Nixon has this power being, you know, the president. It's not just about wiping out the planet. It's about, you know, hitting the right people who have the right ideas, who have the right status, and him being powerful enough to facilitate that, but smart enough to do the right thing with it. And that's, you know, that's, I think, what you're trying to get at with kind of the smaller scale stuff that mm-hmm. is what you appreciate in these things.
Yeah, for sure. And even with the in the future, like the post-apocalyptic world, even those sequences are pretty small. I mean, the biggest thing that happens is Magneto breaking apart the plane and throwing it at the Sentinels. But yeah, no, just I just loved the scale of the movie, you know, because it was smaller than what we're used to at this point.
Right. Yeah. JFK was a mutant.
First of all, I want to talk about the two elements of that, like the two scenes where Kennedy gets brought up, JFK gets brought up. Magic bullet reference, buckets. Great. I thought it was wonderful.
I thought it was like a long time coming, you know what?
Oh,
I mean,
really? Yeah,
no, I mean that in the best way. Like, it just seemed with all the kind of the talk about how else do you curve a bullet. I mean, I kind of really like the JFK conspiracy theory thing to begin with, so mm-hmm. that's one thing. But yeah, I mean, how else do you curve a bullet? And you know, Magneto being the one that controlled it or tried to control it, and he still didn't work out his way and just kept adding wrinkles to it. I thought it was great. I still love the 70s time period in this movie.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Like, and all the stuff about having just lost a war and, you know, distrusting the government and losing the people's approval, you know, Vietnam to Iraq. We probably talked about it in Days of Future Past. Yeah. But you know, I thought that stuff just still worked, and I thought it was just a bit more content and a bit more of a social foundation to build these interesting action ideas on.
Yeah.
I love that stuff. And yeah, the JFK stuff was good. But you said that what was the other part?
The second
JFK
part when they bring it up is because I mean, we go for a while believing that Magneto was the guy that killed JFK, and then it's revealed that he was trying to stop it. And then, you know, the reveal that JFK was quote unquote one of us. And I thought that was so great. And really just the contrasting of not just Nixon in this movie, but Nixon's image and JFK's image, adding the whole human versus mutant thing to that was really great.
Yeah.
And the reference to stopping Nixon's recorder made me really happy as well.
Yeah.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah, Just a couple small things that I think can add so much, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think the First Class dealt with real world events more, but the few things that Days of Future Past chose to interact with were just great, great choices.
Right.
Yeah.
I have a question for you about differences.
Can't wait.
Okay. The first X-Men, based on an original script, not, you know, obviously based on the characters from the X-Men, but,
yeah.
You know, not a specific issue or storyline. Mm-hmm. And we don't get a lot of that anymore.
Not based on like an arc from the comics, like Days of Future Past or the Winter Soldier.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Something like that. You know, it's not always, you know, this is from Amazing Spider-Man 11 through 25, but you know, they'll take pieces from different time periods or just one. Do you think we would ever get a kind of a wholly original one again? Or do you think they, people making these movies feel they need to address some of those because they need to satisfy the fans, or what do you think of that? Do you think it would ever happen again? And what's the reason why or why not?
I mean,
it just struck me that this was based on the first X-Men was based on an original script, and I just don't know when else that happens anymore.
I think it still does. I assume Guardians of the Galaxy will be not based on an arc. I think anytime where you've got to set up a lot of things, you've kind of got to take bits and pieces away.
I think Guardians of the Galaxy is trying to be a really big intentional curveball.
Okay. See, I think it's going to be less of a curveball than people seem to think. Just because you can only curve so much.
Yeah. Trouble with the curve, right?
I was thinking about that movie 2 days ago. I was like, why am I thinking about this fucking movie? It was a piece of garbage.
Well, even if it's not going to be that different, I think it kind of thinks of itself as different. I think it... Yeah, I don't know if...
It's the Rebel Cell superhero movie.
Kind of, yeah. I think it sees itself, and a lot of people I've seen talk about it, like, this is going to be the start of, like, the second phase of this superhero boom. Like, let's start getting the little characters involved. Let's, and I think, I thought it was going to happen with Ant-Man, too. I thought, you know, they've got Edgar Wright, he's going to have some fun with it, he's going to make it, kind of sillier and more fun, and still interesting, but change it up. And now he's off the project for what seems like reasons, like he was going to do just that and they did not want him to. Even like the casting of Paul Rudd totally plays into that.
Yeah. I think just going back to your original question, I think certainly recently we've gotten more things based on, you know, arcs and but even, I think, say, X-Men 3 The Last Stand, I think that was two separate arcs put together, the Cure and the Dark Phoenix.
There's plenty of that. That's what I mean. It's not necessarily one stretch of issues or something. I think they take pieces from a lot of different things.
Yeah, I just think that there are pieces from a lot of different things in the first X-Men movie, just maybe not, you know, hard events, right?
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think we're... getting, because I think part of the reason for maybe the original screenplay existing in X-Men is that it was such a outside of Batman, what superhero movies are there in the 90s, you know, I mean, not counting the Roger Corman ones, I don't think there are any. And it's just kind of a thing that, are we able to go down this path without Superman or Batman? And they had to really be able to tailor what they would use and what they wouldn't. And so they just took the elements that they felt were really important to the characters and turned them into the, just a good action movie that happened to be about superheroes.
Yeah. They couldn't nerd out too hard when they know this market was, as big as we now know it is.
Yeah. And I mean, there's still lots of fan service stuff in the first X-Men, like Rogue's hair or, Wolverine's comment about the outfits. It's still, intentionally accessible. And I think not using too much of an arc, actually helps that accessibility. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yep.
I have another question about kind of fan service a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of going back to what you said about the last 10 minutes of this movie, and you said it didn't work too hard to kind of set up sequels. And, you know, you did concede that obviously it does set up a sequel, and it still exists in the bigger world that they've been working on. Do you think that they've become, I mean, these movies have become sort of too interconnected to a fault? Like they spend more time kind of servicing the universe and referencing other things and other movies in the future instead of making a good standalone film? Because even Days of Future Past, you know, we reference and flash back to X-Men Origins Wolverine, which people didn't really like.
The first one everybody hated. The second one, the people that saw it liked it. For the most part.
Yeah, I thought it was good.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. And I just mean it's always been part of comic books that there's always been different worlds, and that, you know, Spider-Man came in to help Superman this time, and, you know, now he's gone and he's off doing his own
different companies. How dare you?
You get my point.
The nerds would have freaked out on the boards about that.
The boards.
Yeah, our website's message boards. Good luck finding them.
You know what I mean, though? There's always kind of been that feeling that, you know, there's a huge world out here. This is only the tiny part, but you need to go buy this issue and, you know, to put it in these terms, you need to watch this movie and, you know, go rent this movie. Do you think that it's become a detriment to these movies that they are having to work so hard to place themselves in this universe instead of making, as I said, a good standalone movie and do constant reboots and kind of what we saw with this movie in the multiverses hinder that?
I do, in general, my answer to that question is yes. The movies are generally hindered by the fact that they have so many different things to worry about. I think the real problem with it, to me, doesn't come with engaging with things that have happened in the past, because that's kind of always been an element of making sequels to something, is that, you know, in order to make a really good sequel, you have to assume that the person has seen the first movie, because you have to be able to not have to redo the origin story so that people can keep up, you know? But I think the problem comes, and again, this is something in personal conversations and in previous podcasts that I've brought up, the problem really comes with tying in the next movie and, you know, not talking about what just happened, but talking about what's about to happen. And Marvel is the worst offender of this, all of their movies, because it's the biggest of the universes so far. So it has more to set up and it spends more time doing it. And that was the thing. I felt like Days of Future Past was going to be the movie where X-Men kind of switched over to that. And I'm so happy they didn't, because I think if we're looking at this movie and Captain America, The Winter Soldier, up until the hour and 40 minute mark, I maybe like Days of Future Past slightly more. And then the last 20 minutes of Captain America take it down quite a bit for me. Whereas Days of Future Past, it at least stays even with the, if not getting a little bit better because of that bow that I've been talking about so much.
And you liked Cap too.
Yeah, I did. I liked the elements of Captain America 2 that I liked a lot.
Yeah.
It's just, it just felt like a slap in the face at the end of the movie, where it's like, oh, you've made a good, oh, wait, nope, you fucked it all up by trying to make another good movie that I can't see for 3 years.
Yeah.
But, and yeah, this movie, we talked about this on a podcast. I think this is like episode 11. We've talked about the Bourne Ultimatum, how the real climax of that movie is information being shared. And I really enjoyed how this movie ended up being, the crux of this movie ended up being about turning one violent person into a non-violent person, and that person being Mystique. And you know, different points throughout the movie, I'm kind of rolling my eyes like, oh, they're just trying to shoehorn Jennifer Lawrence into this and all that stuff. But it ended up working so well. And the idea that the climax of the movie is kind of a conversation, like we get all that cool big effect stuff of Magneto moving the stadium. to set up just this literal arena for this conversation to take place. But it is Xavier trying to convince Mystique not to shoot somebody, and I think that's really great. And it also really ties into the idea of the movie. And there's a conversation where I think Beast is talking about the one ripple in the pond doesn't really do anything, or river doesn't really do anything. It just ends up correcting itself eventually. And Charles's response, I don't remember if it's in that scene or eventually, where he says, the idea is that with enough ripples, you can change the tide. And I think that's a really, really good idea that they get across. And Charles has spent a lot of time talking about hope as well, both old Charles and then eventually new Charles. And it's a way to get across a really interesting, nice message without going over the top and making it too, like, saccharine and Spielbergian. And I liked it a lot. You know, it's this really, and it again boils down to the idea of thought versus action, the Xavier versus Magneto idea, and just great stuff. Big fan.
Yeah, and when I can tie something in, you know, we've both said we like that action versus thought thing, and when you can have something that's been pervasive throughout the movie, you know, tie in and be consistent thematically for your climax, then, you know, that's a good climax to me. That's a way you're supposed to end your movie.
Yeah, exactly. And just the fact that the villain, what is the villain? Like, it's so great. I was just like halfway through the movie, like, who is the villain of this movie? And then I got way more excited about this movie because it's like, well, who? Yeah. It's just.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. So, got anything more to add?
No. Email us if you want us to talk about something for next week, because we don't have our minds made up yet, right?
Yeah, get us on Twitter. Actually, I don't know if I still know the password for our email account.
Okay,
that's why we haven't mentioned it in like a year. But yeah, follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men. One thing I didn't mention about this movie, and it's present in the first X-Men movie, and I really enjoyed it, is the amount of teamwork used in the action sequences, like the actual like. Is her name Blink making the portals?
Yeah,
that was so awesome.
Fan Bing Bing.
Oh god, that actually, was so great.
I know. I had a note just that says the portals were so much fun, and yeah. I couldn't find a way to organically work it in there. But yeah, no, that was great. Yeah, just a, like just good action, just just fun stuff.
And that part with Fassbender in Paris, or Magneto in Paris, where he's chasing after Mystique. He's gotten out of the fight in the pond, or sorry, the fountain with Beast, and he's just walking after Mystique, soaking wet. There's three cops behind him or whatever, pointing their guns. He doesn't even look at them. He's just so focused and just throws them all backwards. That shot was so awesome. And yeah. I know it wasn't in all the trailers, but still in the movie, I just was still really excited about it.
And this little thing that caught me off guard was him moving Mystique by the bullet in her leg.
Yes.
Yes. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was pretty great.
Yeah, I just felt like I should have known it as soon as they started using it, like it was going to happen, but I didn't, and it made me happy.
Yeah, just a lot of really great, small, thoughtful things in this movie, and really well done, and I think they had their work cut out for them, and I think it ended up pretty great. So
they knocked it right out of RFK Park.
Yeah, exactly. No matter where RFK Park is currently, they're knocking it out of the park. But yeah, thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Again, follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men. And we'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.